Now, normally, girls and boys and whatever that is lurking in the corner of the room, normally I get given an interview to do. The production comes down and says, we got this, that, and the other for you. And you think, okay, yeah, that's going to be, you know, he's a musician, he's a singer, he's a songwriter, he's done this, that, and the other, because obviously on a Friday afternoon, we like to throw things up in the air a little bit. And when I was handed Scott Page's, I just thought, okay, well, it says on here that, you know, it said the notes are so criminally underfunded here, because it said, sax player, because I found enough for Pink Floyd, Supertramp, and Toto. So I thought, okay, it'll be sort of some sort of gigging musician. And then you dig a little deeper, and I'm totally blown away by my next guest. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from, I believe, somewhere on the West Coast. Well, saxophonist, guitarist for Pink Floyd, Supertramp, and Toto, but so much more. Scott Page, good morning to you.
Good morning, my friend. Thank you for having me on your show.
Pleasure is all mine.
How is it back there in Europe? How are you over there?
We're missing
overseas.
You. Overseas. We're missing you since you went away, Scott. What can I say? It's not too. We're down. We're throughout Spain, but this particular studio from which I'm speaking to you is down on the southern coast of Spain, just close to Gibraltar, and it is a glorious Friday afternoon. August,
nice.
August, of course, nice and warm. You know, we can't. It's, you know, it's bearable. We're getting through. How's it? You're over in California. California, no?
Yeah, yes, yep. I'm in Glendale, California, and boy, it's going to be a hot one today, I'll tell you. But it's beautiful, beautiful. The weather's been great.
So that's good to know. I was told, you know, I'll give him a press lesson. She said, yeah, saxophonist, guitarist, just a few things you've done. Talk me through. Should we start off with the Supertramp experience, shall we? Was it the what was the final? It was the trying to think, the Famous Last Words tour, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I did three albums with Supertramp back in the day. Famous Last Words, Free as a Bird, and Brother Where You're Bound. We did those albums, and we toured on that for quite a few years. Great experience, great band, great players, incredible musicians. It was a really wonderful time for sure.
I mean, when did you decide, and what were your musical roots? I mean, who, you know, because guitarists, saxophonists tend to be is a bit of a rare breed, you'd have to say.
Yeah, you know, I actually came from my father. My father was a musician. I grew up on a television show called The Lawrence Welk Show. I don't know if you know that one over there, but it was early television. It was on every week back in the day when we only had like seven channels on television.
Right.
But he was a musician, and he was a doubler also. He played oboe, English horn, flute, clarinet, saxophones. And he was the one that said to me, he said, you know, if you're going to, you know, be in the business at all, it's good. If you can double, play some multiple instruments, it makes you a little more valuable. So that's my career has always been around being able to double, you know, so it really helped because a lot of times, you know, just being a saxophone player trying to get a job, it's a little easier when you got a saxophone and a guitar because, you know, saxophones usually don't play through all the songs, especially in the rock, you know, in the rock vein, you know. So it's been very, very good doubling. And I love playing both instruments very much. It's definitely a gift for sure.
And who were your early influences and what led up? Because you didn't say, right, I've got a saxophone and just rock up to Supertramp, you know, to Hodgson and say, by the way, I think I'll join this band.
Yeah, you know, I grew up actually when I was a kid, I was playing in a kid band called Merciful Soul Band, which was basically David Page and Jeff Beccaro from Toto. They had started that it was a kid band early. They went off and did Toto, and then I ended up joining them again a bunch of years later. But, you know, I played in, you know, all the standard stuff as a kid. You know, you play in marching bands, you do that. And then my dad was also a serial entrepreneur, and he was one of the, you know, the developers and developed the wah-wah pedal, which is the famous music guitar pedal, you know, that everybody from Jimi Hendrix used. And then that we also had a recording studio, which was Sound City, which is the famous studio where, you know, Nirvana and all those guys did those records.
And Fleetwood Mac did Rumors.
Yep,
and
all that stuff. Yep. So
yep.
That was I grew up in that area. Yep.
Oh, right. Okay. And the famous Nerve Desk from Sound City. Didn't Dave Grohl take it with him, didn't he?
Yeah, Dave took that back. That's what he went in and he bought that board and brought it, put it in his studio. Yep, yep. Those were the days, man. Those were crazy days back in the day when we were making records like that. That's for sure.
Now, in a modern high-tech studio, I'll just go off on a tangent here because this is kind of what I do. People think now because it's everything on computers and everything is done on auto-tune and the whole thing. But Sound City there were so many great albums that come out of that particular studios. And you would drive past it, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. No, you couldn't even see it. It was in like a little industrial park back in right off of Roscoe Boulevard in the valley here in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. And you couldn't see it because we had to drive through this little archway and go into this parking lot in the back. Yeah, it was just basically when we saw it, it was just when we went in there, it was when my dad and myself went there one night. It was to basically when they take the building, it was just four big walls in this industrial park. And who knew that that would be one of the great, you know, recording studios of all time at that time, that's for sure. It's funny to look back now and say, wow, I can't believe all the records and things that came out of that place.
And if anybody listening hasn't seen the documentary about Sound City, I urge them to watch that over the weekend. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, actually, he did a great job. Except, you know, what's interesting is Dave kind of left out the beginning. He said in the beginning it was called, Thomas Orton Company and Vox. That makes the amplifiers. That's who my dad was working for at the time when he developed all the amplified instruments. And they built that studio originally for him to develop his amplified band. And it was actually a recording studio. In the movie, they got it wrong. They said it was a warehouse for Vox, which was not correct at all. I mean, that's where we first built that room. And it was a studio. I used to set up chairs and stuff for James Brown coming in there when I was a kid to do sessions and stuff back in the day. So they got it a little bit wrong on the movie. I actually was going to give Dave a call and say, hey, Dave, you missed a part of that. I was there, buddy. I was there the whole time.
What was it like setting up chairs for Dave, for James Brown?
You know, it's really interesting. He was one of those guys that always liked to play in front of an audience. So before he would go cut any tracks or do anything, he would have his sort of his entourage all around him, right? So he always liked to have people in front of him. So it was kind of interesting. And then later years, I actually got to play with him. And that was really an incredible experience. You know, one of my all-time hero musicians, for sure. You know, I think he's one of the legendary guys. And so it was kind of fun to be able to play with him later on in the years, for sure.
A notorious taskmaster, wasn't it? Because you had to be on your game at all times with James Brown.
Oh, no question. I mean, there was no kidding around. He was, you know, he made everybody the drummer. He walked around and he said, okay, what do you play? I saxophone. No, you don't play saxophone. You play the drums. What do you play? You play the trumpet. No, you don't. You play the drums, right? Because his whole thing was the groove, right? It was all about the beat. Yep. Crazy.
So your former childhood friends go off to form Toto. You do a bit with Supertramp, and then you get involved with Pink Floyd. Now, what stage of Floyd's evolution are we talking about here?
Yeah, I joined the band when sort of the later years, the Momentary Lapse of Reason, Delicate Sound of Thunder period. I played on that album. Actually, I was, you know, we were Supertramp, and Dave Gilmore came to do a solo on the record we were working on. And I got to know him a bit. He came to my gig that night. I had a club gig that night just down the street from where we were recording, and he came and hung out. And then we got to know each other. Then a few weeks later, I had a big event that I was doing. He came to that along with Jeff Beccaro, who was playing on this event I did at Guitar Center. And it was a thing called The First Dance, where I was kind of experimenting with zooming microphones and you know, these kind of MIDI-based tripod systems and things that we were building back in the day. And he came to that show. He saw me, called me back and said, hey, come put a solo on the record. So I went and played on the Momentary Lapse of Reason record. A few days later, he calls me up and said, hey, we're taking the band back out again. Would you like to join the band, do this gig? And it's funny, I actually almost turned it down because I didn't realize, I really knew nothing about Pink Floyd at that time, which is kind of funny because I grew up in the kind of the area of, you know, kind of Junior Walker and Stevie Wonder, and I was really more of an R&B, you know, kind of funk player, and didn't really pay much attention to that, what I'd call the, you know, the psychedelic era. And I actually almost turned that gig down. And I that night, I remember going out because I didn't really know anything about it. I went to Tower Records, which was open 24/7 in those days, and picked up the Floyd record, came back and listened to it, said, okay, I kind of get it. And, you know, again, I've been a big R&B guy, not really paying much attention to that. And then I talked to a few friends of mine, and everybody was saying, you're crazy if you don't do that gig. So I ended up doing it, and I'm very thankful. One of the smartest moves I ever made.
What's it like touring with the Floyd in presumably, is it the late 80s?
Yes, late 80s. Yes, that was the main thing. 85, 86, 87, 88, 89. Kind of that last part of the 80s. Oh, it was incredible. I mean, you know, it's truly one of the incredible bands of all time. You know, that brand, the Floyd brand worldwide is just crazy. I mean, we went around the world a couple times on that tour and pretty much sold out all the shows. You know, Dave Gilmour is probably my all-time hero mentor. I learned a ton from that guy. He really changed my playing dramatically, because, you know, when you're learning to play originally, you know, playing with a lot of stuff, especially being a saxophone player, you try to play a lot of notes, all that kind of stuff. And I realized, because Dave Gilmour is the master of melody, right? He plays melodies, you know, licks that you can remember and hear. Because, I mean, it's imagine hearing Comfortably Numb without the guitar solo in the middle. Yeah. Wouldn't make any sense, right? So he was one of those. So I really changed my whole playing to be much more simple, much more melodic because of him. And I learned a ton from Dave. And, you know, he's one of the great guitar players of all time. There's no doubt.
And also
so musical.
There's also that whole, you know, the Floyd don't just set up, kick a wah-wah pedal on and go. I mean, there's the whole, I mean, I remember that. I was, you know, of a certain age in the late 80s, and I remember that tour and the stage and the singing and the whole thing. I mean, it was a theatrical experience. And you got into that as well with your Think X. Is it? Am I saying that correctly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I've been, my whole thing is beyond just being a musician. I've kind of been a serial entrepreneur. I've launched four companies. I took one of them public. I've been really in the technology space. So I've been that guy that's been the kind of bridge between technology and music through the years. And, you know, I started to realize that, you know, music, you can't sell anymore. There's no place to sell music, right? The game has changed. It's all about streaming and, you know, try to make any money in that. So where is the money in the business today? And really where it is, it's in the experience. So there's kind of a couple things that you can sell today as an artist is the experience and the relationship, which is tied to the lifestyle and things like that. So I've decided to, because my other companies have all been tech companies, I decided to get into the, start really focusing back on getting back into the music scene. And so we started Think Experience, which is an immersive entertainment company. And Think X is the band. And the band is, it's Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction and Ooh. Kenny Olson from Kid Rock's band and Norwood Fisher from Fishbone, and it's a great rockin' smoking band, and we have a great time, and we've been doing kind of mashing things together in a unique way. We just finished playing 40 shows in a 360 degree immersive dome in Los Angeles. We sold out all those shows. Incredible. And our first Think Experience was a Think Floyd experience. So we've been doing Pink Floyd in that dome, but doing it kind of in our own way. And now we're kind of mashing Floyd with electronica in some interesting ways and getting ready to go to Canada to do 9 shows there coming up in December. And again, we really see the experience, the immersive space. We've been experimenting with all kinds of ways to create a new experience for people. One of the things we were just getting ready to start, which is kind of interesting, is a friend of mine who's a big venture capitalist. They just put like $10 million into this company that's created shoes that you put on that turn you into a speaker.
I'm sorry?
And shoes that you put on that turns you into a speaker. Can you believe that?
Okay.
Unfortunately, because of the COVID thing, we got completely shut out and we weren't able to do that. But we like experimenting with, you know, all types of new things. And now we're developing a whole new business because we this COVID thing completely took us out, right? Yeah. Took everybody out. We were supposed to be at Jazz Fest this year. We were going to be touring Europe. And we've also were involved in putting up this 1600 seat immersive dome theater here in Los Angeles. All this stuff stopped. So when that happened, I said, okay, what are we going to do? So I started looking at the opportunities that are coming out of this, sort of pandemic, this situation, because I think right now, without a doubt, it's probably one of the most exciting times for an entrepreneur that I've ever seen, because there's so many problems to be solved. So we're really working on how to focus on developing new ways to create a live experience tied to a streaming experience. But, you know, today the streaming experience is not just one way, it's two way. So we can bring people in. And then I'm also tying it to delivery service. So we can now deliver a cool box, basically a party box that goes in, that works directly with the stream and things that we're doing. We just did an experiment where we brought in, we went into a sound stage, set up big LED walls, and then we surrounded the band with 18 80-inch video monitors, monitors, and we brought the whole audience in on Zoom from all over the world, and they were completely surrounded us on the stage, and it was fantastic. It was like, it really felt like people were actually there, which they were, and, you know, it was fun to be able to interact and things. So we're getting ready to launch a whole new project. It'll be called Livin.Live. It's a whole show thing based on this kind of new business model of kind of developing all this tied together.
Can I just ask you a question on this one? Because if you're in it with a band and you've got a tight band, the whole thing, I mean, you're playing a gig, you've got the audience in front of you. But if you're playing a gig like this with these screens, you know, changing between various people watching around the world, isn't it difficult not to sort of, because if we do this in Zoom meetings, you know, you start looking at people who are scratching their noses or other bits during the meeting. I mean, if you're halfway through a solo and you look up and somebody's doing something in, I don't know, you know, watching in Nairobi, you think, man, they shouldn't be doing that. I mean, focus.
It's funny. It's very interesting because, you know, one of the things I did notice is, you know, people were tuning in from their cars. They were tuning in from different places. But yeah, some people had their guitars out and they were jamming with us. It was very interesting. But, well, you know, what's funny about that model is, you know, everybody's the same size on the screen. So it's like everybody's in the front row.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But it was fascinating to talk to people across the globe on the screen. Hey, Bob, how you doing, man? I haven't seen you in ages. You know, hey, how you doing? What are you doing? Taking requests and things. So, you know, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I think that I don't, you know, the world has definitely shifted. I believe that, you know, this pandemic and everything has really pushed us five years forward on where we would be right now. I mean, we're actually moving into the hives, you know, people are moving into groups, and this whole communication stuff is now becoming, you know, a daily occurrence. People are getting used to it. So we got to think outside the box and create some new opportunities.
And that whole thing about, you know, bringing the, I mean, we always used to say, you know, the even when we had the old hi-fi, you're bringing the sound to your home. But if you're bringing, you know, now it's a streaming process, it's much more immediate. You know, everybody's getting systems which are better at receiving this stuff. And I like the idea of a party box. You know, you're getting this ThinkX party box rocking up by a delivery service the day of the concert. You know, don't open this until 2200 hours.
That's exactly it. You know, I mean, again, we can theme base our strategies around that. And it's actually pretty cool. People love it. You know, we've been doing some testing where I'm a big lean startup guy, I'm, you know, building a company. So I like to test and validate everything before we go into full blown, you know, work on all of this stuff. But, you know, so I'm very optimistic about what this is, because I believe people are going to be wanting to stay home yet. I mean, they're trusted source. They want to be there and hang out with their friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the States, people love Super Bowl parties, right? They love to get together for live events. And now that we have the power to be able to launch a live stream basically for one person or 1 million people, it doesn't really matter. You can instantaneously, because, you know, right now I'm talking to you on a worldwide broadcaster, my telephone.
Indeed.
You know, I can, you know, it's crazy what we can do. And I mean, the power of technology today is insane.
The other thing is, because of the streaming services that we have in terms of music and the downloads and the stuff and how that has impacted the music industry negatively, as you could say, because people don't buy albums. Albums anymore. This is
correct.
Perhaps, and people go on tour, bands and musicians go on tour to make money. That's where the money is, the merchandise, the whole thing. The tours make you the money, the record, you know, the downloads don't. This perhaps is a way, you know, I have been following concerts where you get an artist playing in the Roundhouse London, and you pay your £12, your €12 for your gig, or €24 with the pack, because you get the merch turn up. And this is a way perhaps that you can connect with your artist and make sure that you are in a way cutting out the middleman and your band can survive.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's the whole thing. We're now moving into a complete direct-to-consumer business model across the board. Everything is going direct-to-consumer. Every business is now a media company. You have to be in the media business now. If you look at it, I don't care what you're selling. You know, people don't realize, you know, the largest toy distributor in the world is McDonald's. believe it or not. So, I mean, everybody's in the entertainment business now. So it's just the way of the world. And we're actually, like I said, we're moving into what we call hives. People are starting now to follow into groups. That's why you see, you know, on Facebook, all these Facebook groups, everybody's moving into that new space. So really the dollars today for the artist and everything is really in the super fan, what we call the super fan. And now, because we have access to the data and can actually see, you know, can, you know, put our message in front of the people that we actually want to see, it's really around those, that model that Kevin Kelly from Wired Magazine kind of coined years ago, called the 1,000 true fans. A true fan is somebody that will spend $100 a year on you. If I have 1,000 of them, there's my first $100,000 in revenue. So it's not about giant audiences like it used to be. It's really more about kind of those niche audiences, but those people that will actually really write a check. And that's that super fan, because we now know through the data that it's roughly 1% to 3% of your audience will be your super fans. And that's where 60% of your revenue is going to come from. So it's really about building these super fan, highly niche-oriented audiences. But, you know, again, I say for artists, I think it's the greatest time in history for the independent artists, but they have to get educated, right? They have to learn how the new models work and get in there. And I think because of this COVID situation, it's forced so many musicians to like, okay, I got to figure out what I'm going to do. So you're seeing a lot of guys are now jumping in, trying to figure out new ways to kind of generate revenue. Because think about it, with this direct-to-consumer model, one of the exciting things to be able to go direct is I can also take the order. In other words, I can receive the money without a bank or anything. I can just very simply charge somebody for something and make it happen. Now, the hard part is making sure you have something people want to pay for, right?
Yeah.
But that's like anything, you know, it sounds easy, but again, it's really about creating value for your customers. No different than business has been for years.
You know how, you know, some people sort of kicked back and took it easy during lockdown. Something tells me, Scott, but that didn't really cross your radar.
No. We, you know, it was funny. The day I woke up in the morning, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, the only thing that's real is you and me talking right now, which is true. Right. There's nothing. 5 minutes ago is an illusion. 5 minutes from now is an illusion. And so even though we had all, this was going to be our biggest year for Think, it was going to be incredible. We had all these things booked. I woke up that morning and realized everything is shut down. It was over. I just got up and said, well, you know, all those things were just illusions, too. They never happened.
That's a great way of looking at it. Yeah.
I mean, who knew what was going to happen? I mean, I could have went to New Orleans for the thing, fell down and hurt myself. Or, you know, who knows? So I just completely shifted and said, wow, this is an incredible new shift in the on the planet. And so I'm just going to start looking for opportunities. And that's where we started just, you know, focusing on where is it at? And really, for me, it's, you know, being a technologist for years and, you know, having tech companies, it's just really the big driver right now is the two-way, the ability to be able to two-way stream, because now you're seeing the behaviors like, you know, I notice how you know, I'm always kind of trying to figure out what are the trends and what's happening. And you just notice people are like hanging out on their phones with, you know, four of their friends on a FaceTime or a Zoom call. And one of them's watering, the other one's cooking and stuff. And people are starting to use that now as sort of they're getting used to that. So with that new behavior coming into place, which truthfully we knew was coming, but we didn't think it was going to be here for another 5 years or so because of the time, but this has just driven it. So, you know, like I said, I'm very excited about new opportunities, and I'm totally up for like getting up and going to make stuff happen every day.
If people want to follow you, and I advise they do and find out what you're up to and what's going on, and they totally, because apparently you think with both sides of your brain, I've heard before. Someone said that.
Yeah, I like both sides of my brain.
where can they find you, Scott, on the internet?
Yeah, so my personal social is IAM Scott Page, at IAM Scott Page, or you can Google, you know, if you want to find out about Think, you can Google Think EXP. Think EXP, just Google that and you'll see everything, our dome shows, interviews, all the kinds of stuff on that, and that'll lead us to all the other socials.
Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. Have a great rest of your morning. Something tells me you're going to have an active day, Scott.
Got an active day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so very much for having me on your show.
Take care.
Take care, my friend.